just curiosity. The fact that the background doesn't have any non-vertical fluctuation doesn't make any big difference. I mean, there's some theory that you can bring to bear on it.
The background doesn't.
450 is always rotational, so you
use. It has bearing on the development of this little packet, yeah. But I guess, did I answer? I'm going to assume later on that the packet doesn't have any large scale vorticity right next to the packet. So it's not immersed. It's immersed in potential flow. Okay, that just makes things simpler. Yeah. So this little packet it has its own vorticity field. Is there a question?
Yeah, we still don't know what you're solving.
Oh, well, you'll see it right on the next page. The next page. So this is this little packet of vorticity has a very weak vorticity field, and has a compact vorticity field, and it really just responds to the local velocity and velocity gradient tensor. So the total velocity field is the large scale velocity field plus the velocity field of the little object, and the vorticity field is similar. This is the large scale vorticity and this packet, and so the packet just moves with the large scale motion. So the center of the packet just moves with the capital U. And initially the packet is so small that it only really sees the velocity at the center and the velocity gradient. Okay, so these are just definitions. So the next page shows you what, so here's the packet satisfies the linearized vorticity equation. Okay, so that's, here's the convection relative to the center of the packet. So this is in a coordinate system that moves with the center of the packet. And so this is the convection velocity that's left over. And here's the vortex stretching due to the mean vorticity and vortex stretching of the little packet due to the large-scale velocity and the viscous term. Okay.
So both so-called mean vorticity and vorticity fluctuations are weak and compact.
The mean vorticity is not necessarily weak, but it's very weak where the little vortex is. So weak that it's zero.
Yeah, but it has also weak gradient. That's why you drop the mean gradient.
Oh, this the gradients.
Oh, it's the part of a shape.
This is not necessarily small.
No, vorticity gradient. Mean vorticity
gradient. Mean vorticity gradient.
No, in the diffusion term. But you're just writing perturbation equation, is that right?
Yeah.
So what happened to the perturbation advection? So you're neglecting that as a higher order?
The perturbation advection?
Yeah, the perturbation velocity and perturbation vortex. Left hand side will also have.
Well, here's the perturbation velocity appears here.
That's velocity. U J L on the left hand side. B omega I.
Oh well, that's a nonlinear term, yeah. So that it's okay. That's small. Yeah. This thing is small compared to this. This guy here is small compared to that, yeah.
Small u is not the velocity induced by the packet, is it?
Yes, it is.
It is, right? But you said that it's so weak that it doesn't induce any velocity.
That's correct. So that's why it doesn't appear over here.
Oh.
But it's not that weak that it can disturb the main vorticity field. So it has to appear here. Later on, I'm going to dump this term, but... Okay.
Why don't you have an equation for less K motion?
Pardon?
Why don't you have an equation for less?
It'll come in later as the environment that this particle sees, but I don't... Somebody else is solving that.
But it is not necessarily independent.
Oh, it's decoupled.
No, so it's like motion in a partly oscillating field. So for small oscillations you have a linear equation, but then you have a linear correction for the potential for the mean field.
I could, yeah,
yes.
But I'm not doing that.
It's only the way, so I mean,
yeah.
That's for such a small perturbation,
yeah.
Related.
Yeah.
It's a kinematic random problem.
Yeah, that's right. So here we have, so my little packet really is just a little vortex ring. It's a spherical vortex ring in the sense that its potential or its stream, its potential in some sense, is just a Gaussian function. And this initial little vector A is proportional to the impulse. The initial impulse. And this is just a simple, easy to use initial condition. Okay, so it's it produces a sort of a Gaussian blob of vorticity that produces as mutual vortex lines. Okay, the initial impulse.
It doesn't look like a
hill spherical
vortex,
does it? Oh, it would look like a hill spherical vortex, but kind of smoothed out. I mean, obviously, hill spherical vortex is a very, you know, the vorticity goes to zero at the radius and so forth. But this would be kind of a diffuse looking thing.
You know,
yeah.
What are the exact conditions for applicability? So, you see, sigma is presumably small, so
yes.
Sigma refers to a small scale. So yep. Once you start differentiating your stuff with respect to x, you get factors of 1 over sigma each time out. So.
Oh, this is a constant.
That's what I'm asking about.
This term is a constant. The derivatives of this vorticity are counted on the left-hand side, and
yeah.
Something else was on the right.
Yeah.
But what is the condition that nonlinear effects for average velocity can be solved? I'm worried because Nazarenko was doing kind of this stuff for non-uniform average motion. The effects of small scales and large scale
are
very
later.
Important.
It's only later. You start from small scale.
How later? What
well, you'll see. You'll see. This thing gains energy, so it has to drain energy out of the large scales. You can take that into account if you want, but I don't know if that's your point. But let's maybe we should wait a minute, and I hope we'll get to answer your question. So the self-energy of this thing is proportional to sigma cubed also, and magnitudes of A squared. The spectrum, self-spectrum of this thing is goes like k squared and then it falls off exponentially. And just to orient everyone a little bit, even a vortex ring with a thin filament vortex ring has the same low wave number spectrum, k squared, which has to do with the net impulse of the vortex ring. But it behaves much differently at large wave numbers. It has this kind of a 1 over k region. And then when the when you finally get to the scale of the diameter of the core, then of course you get some cutoff. So this vortex ring, this little packet, doesn't have any of this 1 over k region. It just has a k squared and then cuts off. So what happens in time? Okay, when there's no mean, when there's no large-scale vorticity, you can integrate those equations using the definition of the deformation tensor. So F is the deformation tensor that evolves under the action of the velocity gradient tensor, capital U. And this matrix M here is the one that takes care of viscous effects. And the impulse vector A evolves just as a surface element would evolve, a differential surface element. So this is the equation of motion for a differential surface element. And here's the solution, given in terms of F. So this is a nice thing to look at and analyze. If omega is not equal to zero, then this little packet is actually producing new vorticity all over the place, because its velocity gradient tensor is non-zero globally. And so if there's any, I'm sorry, yeah, if, so.
Tony, let's yeah. go back to omega equals to zero. What is F, by the way?
F is the is defined by this equation, and it's the deformation tensor for the packet.
And so
for a material element.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
How should I interpret this result? AFT is FT minus 1, A0. What is big T?
Transpose.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting there.
Sorry.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So this is basically a heat equation with convection. Is that?
Well, it's a heat. It's convection of a vector field. It's
okay. Not a scalar.
Not a scalar. And so this is the important element of the vector field. But we'll see later for the scalar. You just the same thing holds, except you don't have to worry about A. Yeah. Okay, if omega is not equal to zero, capital omega, then you have a much more complicated evolution to deal with, which is a lot easier to look at if you go to Fourier space. And here you have to worry about the evolution of A sub k for every k direction k of k zero, e k zero. You have to solve this evolution equation and factor that back in up here, and then do the inverse transform. And that comes. So this term here is the term that comes from the non-local vortex stretching term. So as long as this guy is zero, then this goes away and everything reduces back up to here. But so it's interesting, to me, it's interesting enough to deal with this anyway. Now, big omega is the vorticity field of the large-scale flow.
Large-scale flow.
So
oh, okay.
This would be a term.
I would say you don't have vortex stretching unless you have a large-scale flow.
Last game is a bit late.
Big omega is the local large-scale vorticity at the packet. And so this, I'm assuming that's zero. So this little packet is just floating around in between these large-scale vortex tubes.
So long as it's not actually a metric.
Well, if there's no large-scale vorticity there, then there's no stretching of that large-scale vorticity. But otherwise, yeah, you do have to worry about that. So if you do want to worry about that, then you have to deal with this. Okay, this... I was talking to Claude Cambon about this, and I thought I'd seen various... This equation down here, sometimes called the wave vector equation, but it comes and goes. Cambon tells me that there's a sequence of literature that led to that in blue here, and then there's another group that apparently rediscovered that, and then there's another group that also produced that result. So this is just for amusement.
Who didn't discover this result?
Who didn't?
I don't see your name on
there. I don't see Taylor there, my God.
Yeah. So local induction, rapid distortion theory has been used in sort of a lot of different ways, and this particular way I want to concentrate on the idea that the velocity gradient tensor is going to be kind of a random sequence of velocity gradient tensors just due to the fact that this particle is moving through kind of a turbulent flow. And that's very much different than, say, Julian Hunt and his people have been using rapid distortion theory, where they have sort of arbitrary small scales of turbulence, but then they hit it with very regular global velocity fields. So this is kind of the opposite approach. We have a very simple turbulent object. It's very localized, but then we're going to hit this thing with sort of a random sequence of velocity gradient tensors. So in that scenario, if you look at the deformation tensor times its transpose, you get, and you diagonalize that, then you get the Lyapunov exponents for this stretching of this little element. And you can define lambda 1, 2, and 3 in this way. So this is 2 lambda 1 times time and 2 lambda 2 times time. And this just provides a definition for lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3. And we know that, for example, a line element, it's the length, the growth of the length is dominated by lambda 1, which is the largest of the eigenvalues of this tensor, e to the lambda 2 lambda t, lambda 1 t. And an area element is governed by e to the minus lambda 3 t, which is equal to e to the lambda 1 plus lambda 2 times t. Okay. I've got, so just to give you an example of a 2D chaotic, a flow that produces chaotic advection. If you just take a pair of point vortices without any external perturbation, then they just produce these and you look at streamlines that move with the vortex pair, then you just get, you know, this is, yeah.
Equal and opposite pairs
of vortices, you just get this kind of mundane stretching of material. But then if you have some oscillatory flow that that's added to that, then you get regions of chaotic advection. And, for example, an interface, this is a stretched coordinate system, but an interface initially that looks like that will get all kinds of wild. It'll get horrendously stretched with all kinds of little idiosyncrasies. Yeah. And if you look at particle, if you look at little line elements, let's see, where's my little line element? Yeah, if you look at a little line element, for example, this is the log of the length of a little line element in this chaotic region. It has lots of wild oscillations, and then it escapes. This little line element happens to escape at about 12 cycles in this perturbation, and this is just one little line element. If you look at a whole bunch of line elements, then you get depending on which where these elements escape. If they escape at later cycles, then they suffer a lot larger values of lambda 1 times t. But if you look at any one given cycle where particles have escaped, there's quite a spread here of different values of total stretch. And then if you average over the particles in any given escape cycle, you get some kind of trend here.
This is the oscillatory slope here. Is there a correlation in time or something like that? You know what I'm asking?
No, it's just a real simple periodic, 2D periodic and time flow.
It's you're talking about random.
Yeah, I will for turbulence.
All right.
Yeah, this is. Well, but this thing is random in the sense that any given particle suffers quite a different history than any other particle, even if they're close by to start with. Yeah, exactly.
Are we still in 2D?
Yeah, this is still 2D. Now I'm going to 3D. This is Garamaggi and Pope. Have actually studied what happens to individual particles and kept track of the deformation tensor of all these particles, 4,000 particles, relatively low Reynolds numbers. This is forced isotropic turbulence. And this is what happens. This is the this is the average, first the Opinoff exponent times time for all those particles. And here's the average of the second exponent times time. And here's the average of the third one. Now the sum of these is zero.
This is not the same problem.
This is 3D isotropic turbulence, yeah. It's completely different. they found that it, as far as the Reynolds number dependence goes, the data do collapse on a Kolmogorov time scale. But really, they get a slight positive value of average lambda 2. If you look at their data a little more carefully, it seems like to me that this thing should be increased a little bit.
Yeah, they're around. It's,
yeah, it should be 1/4.
0.30.
Yeah, yeah.
Number one.
Exactly.
Like 4.5.
That's what I thought too. So the ratio would be this would be about 1/4 of this guy.
Yeah, yeah. Think it's 1/4.
Okay, so we agree.
Where did you get this one?
Huh? I used to read this paper.
Yeah. But they found this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I looked at their graphs, and I have other reasons to believe a factor of 1/4 here instead of 1/7. So.
But they were funny. Tell me, ask why they're positive or one negative. And my guess is that it is related to the fact that it is a positive energy flux in 3D. In a way, it is somehow related to the fact that delta UQ is minus 4/5 epsilon R. I think that this somehow could be related.
You have to really fill in lots of blanks.
They also plot the probability distribution for lambda 1 and lambda 2. And so it's kind of a, well, whatever it is, it can't go beyond the so-called pancake shape where lambda 2 equals lambda 1. And it can't go below this cigar-shaped region. Okay, now just, if the flow is somehow reversible, then there, I don't know how, there's, it's a good argument to...
Number 2 is 0.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. So this has been shown in some examples, and also I guess it's proven in some sense. it seems logical.
Looks clear, but
yeah.
I don't pretend it.
Because there are just as many orbits going one way in time as the other way in time, and so lambda 3 and lambda 1 should have somehow symmetric.
And time goes to minus time.
Yeah.
Lambda 1 goes to minus lambda 3.
And the 3, and yeah, it goes to minus lambda 1.
It goes to minus lambda 2. So
yeah. Yeah. Okay. But
numerical result for the ABC flow?
Yeah, I think this one was a numerical result, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah. But does anybody so know of any more computational results? I mean, this is all I've seen. Everybody studies the hell out of the velocity gradient tensor, but not so much the deformation tensor. So.
Yeah.
Well, can I ask if we take that up? You said it was ABC flow. But at the beginning, you said you were.
No. This is not the ABC, the PDF. The PDF is supposed to be turbulence.
So where
so
was
the very lower energy number?
Oh, it says flow mapping.
Oh, no, this is low.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, well, your first comment where you said that you were conceiving of a potential flow with these blobs.
Yeah.
Floating. And Fadley said, well, and essentially, if the blobs were absolutely perfect, you might have Hill's vortices, right? You said, well, that's smeared out.
Yeah.
Okay, now, for Hill's vortex, you've got exact alignment. So the omega aligns with largest eigenvector strain, etc.
This is different, though. I mean,
yeah, so I'm saying, has anybody computed that sort of type of case?
Well, but that's a completely different idea, isn't it? I mean, I'm talking about very weak things where the strain is due to the external field. Mm-hmm. And I think you're talking about the vortex producing its own strain field and what happens. Aren't you?
No.
No?
I mean, but that's kind of clear that if you put vorticity into a strain field, then the component along the highest eigenvalue, which is lambda 1 here, will grow fastest, and then asymptotically vector is completely along the first direction, whatever it is, Hill vortex or whatever you call it.
No, that alignment is the issue. I'm just thinking of spheres or rings, which are morally the same. Sort of, and you're saying that you were thinking of these as sort of smeared out objects when you did your first calculation.
Maybe I can explain. So my original vortex was just a kind of a spherical blob with vortex lines that went around like this. Okay, and that's it. But it had that very simple analytical description.
Right.
And but it's very similar to a Hill's vortex in that a Hill's vortex has the same setup, but it's a much, it's compact support, and the vorticity varies radial like R, goes like R.
Right.
This goes like R e to the minus R squared over sigma squared.
I'm
okay.
Just trying to make corrections.
That's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a fuzzy spherical.
Yeah. So now at later time, not very good sketches, but this. So there's a long length scale due to the largest eigenvalue lambda 1. So this. This initial spherical thing becomes ellipsoidal, and it has a very long length. This in the lambda 1 direction, in the 1 direction, and then it has a medium length scale in the 2 direction, and then it has a very thin region in the 3 direction. So, if we cut through the long direction. This is not. You get kind of a sort of sheet-like things that are a little bit offset. They're not perfectly good sheets, but they look. In fact, you could create this thing by just taking a kind of a symmetric spherical thing and then just shearing it a little bit. Okay, but what happens?
I don't understand the third direction in this figure. Is that sort of vertical out of the board?
Yes.
Sigma e to the lambda 3. Is that perspective, in other words? Is that perspective or contour?
Perspective. It's perspective. I need to get a better visualization here, that's for sure. The impulse. Grows. The impulse is proportional to A, which remember I said satisfied a surface element type evolution, and so you get growth in the impulse according to a surface element. The energy, the total energy, grows like e to the lambda 1, and the energy spectrum, the one-dimensional energy spectrum, is the spherical angular average of omega hat squared over 2. Now omega hat squared has this leading order, the leading terms in that thing are given by this mess of stuff. So what we have to do to look at the energy spectrum itself is integrate over mu and phi. But that's just using kind of asymptotics. It's not too hard to see that, for example, mu equals 0 is where we want to concentrate on, because this term here is the big term of these three terms. So when we integrate over mu, we're going to get concentration near mu equals 0. And then we integrate over phi, and so this thing is now gone. And so now phi plus or minus pi over 2 is going to give us the biggest contribution in that case. Okay, so you do that, and you get this spectrum function. You still get a k squared region for small k, but that's diminishing in range because this cutoff is moving that way.
This is the spectrum for what?
The self energy of the little object. Yeah. So you get a k squared behavior for small k, and then you get an intermediate behavior of k to the plus 1. And then it depends on where this middle eigenvalue is, what it's doing. But anyway, that's the break point there. And then a k to the minus 2. And this thing, well, until viscous effects kick in, this thing is moving off this way at this rate, k3 proportional to e to the minus lambda 3 times t, but remember that's equal to e to the plus lambda 1 plus lambda 2 times t, so that is moving out as fast as a surface element would grow in that way. So the interpretation of k to the 1 is simply this. If you just have two anti-parallel object, tube-like objects, equal and opposite circulation. Each tube all by itself looks like it gives a k to the minus 1 spectrum, but if you put two of these together with small separation, you can produce a k to the plus 1. So in this range from this k to this k, our little packet just looks like two long objects of equal and opposite circulation. So when k gets large enough, though, we can see the details of these objects, and they look like little sheets. So that's why you get k to the minus 2.
What is the strain field looking like? You have said so many things. I'm sort of.
Okay, the strain field is a point function of time that this, I mean, it's just the strain field is whatever the object, this object sees as a function of time as it travels.
Yeah, what is it?
It's a fluctuating function of time that has the statistics such that the, it has eigenvalues e to the e to the lambda 1t and e to the lambda 2t.
And this is fluctuating, you said?
Yeah.
And here, might I ask the same question I asked before?
Which was?
The fluctuation, what is the time correlation in the fluctuations?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It doesn't matter, it should be just much less than the fluctuation time. I mean,
We're just freezing this thing at one particular time, and this is what we get.
This is an accumulative result of a lot of this.
The deformation matrix is accumulate.
It's oscillated theorem that as long as you have oscillated.
So the time t just has to be larger than the correlation time.
The time is much larger than this. Asymptotically, you have three axis stretching interruption.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said the last part of the spectrum is to be interpreted as arbitrary sheets, arbitrarily oriented sheets?
Yeah, actually, there's also a very small k to the zero that comes in down here, which I attribute to sheets that are equal and opposite orientation. So that also is part of this thing.
Where does that occur in the middle?
It comes across here, but it's much weaker than even this at this point. So it's way down here, see? So, but it's so small that I don't believe it's that important.
So how should one imagine this happening? Because randomly varying strain field, two sheets like this aligned, not obvious to me.
Well, this is just what little objects are going to evolve into. And so the question is, when do you start making corrections to that? That's one of the main questions. And for example, later on the the long link scale is going to be so long that the ends of the thing see different gradient tensors, right? So obviously this kind of happens. I mean, everybody knows that eventually this could get very, very complicated. I had a student once compute what happens to a little line, and one little line element can end up like that, but that's that's so what happens is that once this happens, the impulse function actually levels off, and the largest scale can grows a lot more slowly, and so you get some kind of change in what goes on down here for sure. Like I said, this is work in progress. And
but rate of distortion theory is no longer applicable.
No, it's still applicable. You just have to apply it at each different point.
Right. So now you have rate of distortion and transient correction.
I have to use a different function here at each location, but theoretically I could still do that.
So it's not an original theory where you assume that all relevant scales of this small globe are much less than length scale associated with less velocity field, right? So that was your initial assumption. You had a separation of scales.
Yeah.
And now you are saying that only one scale will blow up, so you will have, sort of, say,
I see, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, well, that's right.
And this somehow has to match.
If you look at a scalar, an initial scalar, spherical Gaussian blob of scalar will evolve into, again, ellipsoidal shape. And if you look at the scalar spectrum, it has, the k squared component, a k to the 1 plus 1 component, which is just a kind of a tube of scalar, a long tube of scalar would have this spectrum function. But then once you look at the, once you get enough resolution, you can see that the tube of scalar really is a sheet in cross section, and so it produces a k to the 0. So how does this have to do with a k to the minus 1 spectrum? Well, this whole thing easily integrates over time to a k 1 over k spectrum, because this level is dropping at an exponential rate, which is exactly equal to the rate at which this thing is moving out in k-space. So you do recover the k to the minus 1. Okay.
Do I understand correctly that these pictures are for times small enough so that original rate of distortion theory is applicable? All scales are much less than much needed.
What you need is, you need to have the nonlinear effects of the, well, in the scalar case, we don't have to worry about nonlinear effects. But in the vortex packet approach, we do have to worry about nonlinear effects. And so that's, I mean, that's another, there are all kinds of possibilities. You could have parts of these sheets rolling up and concentrating in the kind of little filament-like objects, and which might produce little regions of k to the minus one in this mixture. But so this is just an idea. Tom Lundgren has made a scenario that sort of this happens in some sense. Oh, there's one. Now this k to the minus, sorry. One other final remark. The k to the minus 1 for a scalar, you can use the same argument to look at passive patches of vorticity in two dimensions. And if they you just follow their evolution, that produces a k to the minus 3 energy spectrum from that. And let's see, where's my... So here's an old calculation by Dritchell that shows, this is not exactly 2D turbulence, but it's, I think it shows some of the effects. This is initially a circular patch of vorticity with a little bump on it. And after 7 revolutions and blowing up the scale, you can see little filaments. 2D, right? This is 2D, yeah. Filaments of vorticity, which presumably, if you looked at enough of these things in a real 2D flow, they perhaps would produce this k to the minus 3 spectrum. Okay, so there's... let me just stop there. Just say there's lots, many welcome your comments, and I'm going to be trying to work on some of these extensions. We could, I want to look at the putting in a viscous term and studying in more detail what happens when you put in viscosity. Just as a small note on that, I was looking at this paper by McLaughlin and Maida, who looked at physics of fluids, 1996, who looked at fluctuations, non-Gaussian probability distributions of scalar in a shear flow, fluctuating shear flow, and it's interesting that they're deformation tensor, you can integrate exactly, get the exact deformation tensor, you can get the exact M matrix, and everything just falls out nicely. But unfortunately, it's just simple shear flow, and it produces only linear stretching. It doesn't produce any exponential stretching. And my thought is, well, maybe we could avoid all this machinery that they use in their paper, but I don't know about the answer to that. Okay, stop there.
Short comment. For a count of viscosity, you may want to look at the very old paper of Pearson, 59. Mm. Pearson studied exactly this kind of problem, and he asked about what is the energy spectrum of small vorticity.
Okay.
This is the isotropic type of...
His answer is very simple. He says that the energy grows like exponent of lambda 1 minus lambda 2 multiplied by T, which is basically the answer that we got for kinematic dynamo for logarithm. But he was telling a little bit oversimplified model. I guess it's JFM59, and our paper there should be reference.
Okay. Okay, good. Yeah.
Thank you. Because I think there's a couple of little bit of an obstacle.